got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. For most of human history, raising animals for food has taken a tremendous toll on the environment. And it's only in the last, say, 20 years or so that we've done a better job of meeting our increasing demand for meat and milk, but also doing a little bit more to protect our natural resources. That's the good news. The bad news is that we are risking a reversal of this very positive trend of protecting the environment as the global population explodes. And I'm sure people have heard the figure of 10 billion people by 2050. So as the population increases and also gets wealthier, the demand for animal products is going to boom. And so we're going to need to rely on some new technologies like gene editing and agriculture, for example, to be able to meet this booming demand, but also protect the very limited resources we have, especially land. So to talk me through this potential livestock revolution is Dan Rato, who is a senior food and agriculture analyst at the Breakthrough Institute. And if you're not familiar with Breakthrough, they are a nonprofit dedicated to discovering and promoting technological solutions to our most pressing environmental problems. And Dan is the co-author of a new report on this topic called Peak Pasture. And so he's going to sketch an outline for us of how we may be able to meet this demand from a growing population without overusing the limited resources we have. And he's also going to answer a few questions for us. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cameron.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So let's jump right into this. So when people hear about animal agriculture or land used for raising food animals, it's usually negative. I know that there's a lot of stories about declining biodiversity, and the term factory farming gets thrown around a lot, sometimes more accurately than others. And indeed, you know, expanding pasture was a problem for many, many years, going far back into history. So before we get into what's coming in the future, can you just summarize the problem that you guys are trying to tackle with this new report?
Absolutely. So the world has really converted an enormous amount of forest and grassland and other types of land into pasture for grazing animals, as you mentioned. Since, I think, the 1700s or so, an area almost the size of North America, in fact, has been converted. So the scale of this issue is very large, and every, acre of land that's being converted does have pretty negative impacts on biodiversity, on habitat loss, carbon storage, and as well as on water storage. So ultimately, the amount of land that we're using in the world for pasture is something that I think any environmentalist or anyone who really cares about the how to feed the planet without wrecking the world should really care about.
Now, something that was really good, at least it jumped out to me as really positive when I was reading your report, is that we've cut the amount of land we use for animal agriculture. I think it was 140 million hectares over the last two decades. Is that right? Do I have those figures correct?
Yeah, it's really a remarkable trend, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more coverage, to be honest. Since around 2000 or so, people have continued eating more and more meat. There are more and more people in the world. I think production or consumption of beef, for instance, has gone up 12% or so. But the amount of land we're using for grazing animals has declined, as you say, about 140 million acres. So that's 2 or 3%. That's, I think, something close to the size of the country of Mongolia. So we're not talking about some very minor decline. This is a truly large and optimistic story that's happening here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into more, of course, of how we're going to keep that decline going in a minute. But at this point, what's really driving that? Because the population obviously isn't getting smaller. As you just said, demand for meat is increasing. So up to this juncture, I mean, what has really allowed us to reduce the amount of land we're using?
It is a mix of different factors. So demographic and behavioral changes are a piece of it. The rate of population growth has been slowing down, though certainly not declining. So that explains a slight piece of this decline in pasture area, but it leaves a huge question: what's driving the rest of it? And that's really been productivity improvements through a wide variety of different practices and systems of producing beef, milk. People are increasing the amount of meat and milk that they can get just per unit of land, per acre, per hectare, and per animal as well. So it's not just that we've crammed in more animals into a smaller amount of land. It's that each animal is really producing producing a lot more. And also, animals are healthier in many cases. They're living, I guess, reproductive rates are higher, fewer calves are dying early, fewer mothers are miscarrying among the cattle herds. So there are quite a wide variety of different factors here.
Yeah, very interesting. And I have a few of those specifically I want to ask you about in a little bit. But the broader issue, I should say, that I want to focus on for just a minute is how counterintuitive this is to people. Because, as I said, in the media, it's presented as we're using more and more land, we're consuming more and more resources, and this is just going to get worse and worse unless we radically change our lifestyles. And that doesn't seem to necessarily be the case when you present that out of context, because we are producing more on less land. And so I'm wondering if you can just briefly explain how that works, because that's a broader trend too when it comes to international development, where countries, they get wealthier, and in many cases the amount of pollution that they're producing goes up for a while, and then once they get wealthy enough, it starts to reduce again. And I'm sure you know that better than I do. So can you explain, is that what's at work here as we talk about this?
That does seem to be the case, yes, Cameron. So many of the wealthiest countries today, the U.S., for instance, saw a large expansion of the amount of land used for grazing much earlier in the century, or last century, really, as population was growing, as people were becoming wealthier and eating more and more meat. But over time, technology really caught up. People started developing more commercial scale operations where they could use really economies of scale to buy higher quality feed for their cattle, to pay for veterinary care. There are developments in antibiotics and crop feed and nutrition in quite a wide variety of different areas, which have enabled producers of really of beef as well as milk, which are the primary things we focus on in our new report, to substantially increase the yields that they're getting per animal. And this is, we've seen this too in other rich countries as well, in Australia, in Europe. In fact, Australia has seen some of the greatest declines in pasture area in the world. But this is this transition from I guess pasture expansion to contraction is only just now really happening in some other parts of the world. So while it may have happened earlier in the 1900s in the U.S., it's really just happening now in Brazil and in the rest of Latin America and parts of Asia as well.
Now, one point you guys make, and this I found actually pretty interesting because I don't hear this made many places, is that consumers won't be able to reduce their food waste and meat consumption enough to offset the increasing demand in the developing world. Can you explain that situation to us? And what is that based on? Is there new research coming out that's indicating that? Because it seems like that's a tough question to answer.
Yeah, that is a tough question. And I don't think anyone can precisely claim to predict the future. We don't have a crystal ball, and no one else does either. However, if you just look at past trends for demographic changes, if you look at how people in Latin America have started to eat more and more beef and more consume more and more milk, eat more and more chicken as they become richer. You can think that something similar will happen in much of sub-Saharan Africa, where today people eat very little meat relative to the rest of the world. But as the population continues to increase and as these countries, we hope, become richer and people are able to live lives of just with greater level of well-being, they'll also start to consume similar levels of meat as we've seen in other parts of the world. So that's really one of the primary ways in which people start to project how much food will be consumed in the future. So we can imagine a world in which case, or we can imagine a world in which meat or milk consumption falls to zero, but it really is just a thought experiment. The most likely case scenario is really to see greater and greater levels of consumption. And most of the best analysts in the world predict that meat consumption in 2050, just 30 years from now, will be somewhere between 50% or 70% higher than where it was back in 2010.
Now, do you see these innovations, like the best known one, I think, is Impossible Foods' Impossible Burger, where you have these plant-based substitutes for meat, and they seem to be really popular. So Burger King has picked up the Impossible Burger, and so have other fast food places. I know Beyond Meat is another competitor. They're expanding as well. And you have all these lab-grown protein sources that are still not on the market, but they are developing quickly. They have financial backing from investors. Do you see those contributing substantially in the next several decades to reducing our environmental footprint from animal agriculture?
I hope so, but I also don't think that environmental groups and other sustainable agriculture groups should count on that. There have been many instances of very environmentally efficient or sustainable technologies which have been developed, such as the electric car, for instance, which have held out great promise for decades without actually being widely adopted. Even today, electric vehicles, honestly, over 100 years after they were first invented, still are driven by less than 1% of drivers in the U.S. So I certainly hope that these alternatives to meat, which do have a much smaller environmental footprint than beef in most cases, I hope that they succeed, but I wouldn't bet all my cards on it. Right now, in the U.S., for instance, rates of vegetarianism have remained below 5%, really, since anyone's been recording that information. And so it could potentially increase in the future, but really what seems to hold, you know, much more promise and something that I'd be much more willing to bet on, actually, is that improved productivity, which we have seen a lot of in the past, will continue to enable people to use less and less land and fewer resources to meet food demand. It's really remarkable, actually, I think, how untold the story of increased productivity is.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff for sure. And one thing I found really, really compelling about what you guys are covering in your report is, in some cases, you're talking about, you know, real extensive developments in technology like CRISPR gene editing and some of those things. And I do want to talk about those. But you also highlight some really simple things, like making sure that animals have shade. You know, I think you said that increases milk production like 15%, and it encourages the animals to reproduce and have healthy offspring. So, of course, we don't have to talk about the importance of shade. I think everybody gets it, especially in the summertime. But tell me about some of these other solutions. I know you said that planting particular grasses can help sequester carbon and also make sure the animals have a nutritious diet. And then you said, I believe you covered as well, crop-based animal feeds. So talk about that a little bit, if you would.
There are a number of different developments that have been really pushing, I guess, the envelope of productivity, some of which you mentioned, like CRISPR, or some people discuss feeding algae to cattle, but many of the greatest opportunities to improve productivity really lie in just transitioning or transferring some of the existing best practices that have existed for a long time in the U.S. or in Europe or Australia and other places to lower productivity regions of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, where producers, ranchers, pastoralists don't have the same level of access to modern veterinary care. As you say, they don't have, in many cases, try and plant as many trees or develop structures to provide their animals with shade when it's overly hot, and in many cases aren't able to protect their animals from the weather in the same way that more, I guess, industrialized producers can. There aren't necessarily protected barns or, types of like concrete flooring or other types of flooring that can protect animals when there's floods or when the ground becomes very muddy. All of these types of environmental conditions can really make animals not just unhealthier, but also less productive. They spend a lot of their energy just trying to sustain themselves. So many of these practices that can improve productivity are quite mundane in some ways. Some other examples, as you say, include planting higher yielding grasses in pasture. People have long been actively managing pasture land in many parts of the world, planting different grasses, in some cases fertilizing the grass, and in many cases even planting trees within pastures to increase the soil health, store carbon, and ultimately to produce more biomass for their animals so that the animals are able to get a lot more food while roaming around the pasture land.
Now, you said most of these methods and these technologies are already available in the developed world. Is there anything preventing people in some of these developing countries from implementing some of these real simple changes?
That's a good question. And in many cases, it's probably what many listeners would expect. It's a mixture of cost. In some cases, some of these inputs such as, antibiotics for when animals are sick or certain types of feeds, are simply unavailable. So some of these changes require somewhat more systemic changes in the country in order for ranchers or pastoralists to have access to the best technical assistance, the best information from researchers and agricultural experts in their country. The country really needs to support the education of those experts and support agricultural extension systems or outreach systems, as some people might call them, to get agricultural professionals out there to ranchers and really, communicate to them what's available for them, what are some changes they might be able to make, and how they can make those.
Now, I believe you guys also said that breeding improved cattle, for example, will make a huge difference in a variety of ways. Can you describe a little bit about how that might improve the situation? I think one example, and you guys talk about this too, is like heat tolerant cattle. Just getting that, to more ranchers around the world would be a big deal, I imagine, as the climate warms up. Can you explain that situation for us?
I can try to. We didn't focus on this as much as we did on the other areas, but if you look at some of the productivity improvements in the U.S., for instance, that have helped ranchers here keep the amount of pasture land steady while dramatically increasing production, a lot of those productivity gains have come from genetics. So especially in the dairy sector analysts and researchers estimate that perhaps the majority of the productivity improvements have really come from new breeding efforts, greater use of artificial insemination, for instance, and overall more actively managed breeding of the herds. This type of approach to breeding could have a very large potential to improve yields of animals in other countries. Right now, in tropical countries, for instance, dairy cows have something like less than a third of the yields that we have in North America and Europe. So you can imagine that such similar improvements in genetics in other countries could potentially, in the long term, bring their levels of productivity up similar to where we are in the U.S. today. There are, as you say, though, some unique environmental challenges. Heat is a major one, and also a variety of tropical diseases plague cattle in much of the world. And that is a challenge that I think breeders have yet to fully solve, but it is one that coalitions of researchers around the world are actively focused on and actively trying to address.
Very good. Well, it's all fascinating stuff. I mean, no one can predict the future, so we'll just have to see what happens in the coming decades. But I would encourage people to read this report. I believe it's called Peak Pasture, and it's on your website. Where can people find this if they want to read it?
They can go to thebreakthrough.org. It should be just on the homepage there. That's thebreakthrough.org.
All right, we'll go check that out. And then, Dan, you're on Twitter as well, right?
I am on Twitter. I'm quite active there, so please find me. I am at Dan Rato. That's a difficult last name. It's D-A-N-R-E-J-T-O.
That's cooler than mine, I think. Very cool last name. Yeah, so...
yours isn't bad.
Yeah, and if I can just give a shameless plug for a second, I think Breakthrough's great. They've done a lot of very interesting work on implementing technology to make the world a healthier and cleaner place. So highly encourage you to follow them. Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Of course. It was a pleasure talking with you, Cameron.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for joining us. If you want to learn more about the podcast, check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. And if you want to join all the other cool kids who have already subscribed, we are on Spotify and iTunes, so you can get the new episodes as they're released through your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.